The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening. And can you hear me okay? Is it on out there? Great. So, it's been the custom here at IMC, my custom, to for the first trouble hearing. It's not quite on. It doesn't feel quite on in here. Why don't you feel a little quiet in here? Because it's working. Let's see, is that any? Yeah, it's on, but maybe a little bit louder. Let's see. How's that? Better now? Yeah, that's better, yeah. You know, there's just the right ring that I hear in my voice. And I think, oh, that's the sound that I like. And then when I don't hear that ring, I don't recognize myself. Thank you. So, let's start over again. It has been the custom here at IMC since we first began in this building, I guess 11 years ago, to have the first talk of the year be on the Four Noble Truths. And I do that on Sunday morning. I do that Monday evening. So I guess it's been about 11 years now. So I gave it yesterday. And for Sunday, and so this, I guess, is the 22nd year, or 22nd time that I'm giving a talk on the Four Noble Truths. And I was beginning to wonder if I'd run out of things to say about it. What other perspectives can I bring? Not that all of you have been to all the different ones. So we'll see how it goes today. I thought I'd talk for a little bit and see how that goes, and then perhaps there can be more of a questions and discussion about it. So what's called the Four Noble Truths is sometimes presented as the key teachings of the Buddha, the core teachings out of which all the other Buddhist teachings flow. Sometimes it's said that all Buddhist teachings can somehow or other fit into the Four Noble Truths. And partly that's said because the Four Noble Truths encapsulate the primary purpose of what the Buddha was trying to point to when he was teaching. He was pointing to the idea that people suffer, and he was trying to offer a way out of that suffering. The language he used was not out of it, but was to end that suffering, to bring that suffering to an end. And so, in many ways, he was teaching that, teaching both pointing towards the nature of suffering, to understand it well, and pointing to the possibility of becoming free of it or to end it. And so everything we're trying to do here at IMC, following the footsteps of the Buddha, is hopefully related to that project, to that purpose. I am deeply touched by the amount of suffering I encounter. As a Buddhist teacher, perhaps more than most professions, I meet people in the fullness and depth of their hearts. I think that often people come to a place like this, to a Buddhist center, to a practice center, because something's not quite working right in their life. And sometimes, say it that way, is just too mild. It isn't things don't quite work. Things are not working at all, or the amount of distress, suffering that people are trying to deal with and work with is quite immense. And so I sit here sometimes with people, and people come and tell me their stories, and the stories are heartbreaking that people have. And what is, I found myself saying a few times this last year when people come with particularly large challenges, is I welcome them and say they've come to the right place, because what the Buddha was teaching, what the practice we're teaching here, is not meant only for stress reduction. It works for that, that helps for stress, but that's really, you know, that's not what the Buddha was about when the Buddha, you know, started teaching, you know. You guys are a little bit too stressed out in ancient India, and I'm going to help you calm down a little bit. But rather, it was really designed, meant to meet people and support people and help people at in some of the most challenging places that people, sooner or later, everyone has to encounter and meet. So the Four Noble Truths are kind of the good news in Buddhism, though sometimes that's hidden by because the first noble truth is said to be suffering. So then that's like a party pooper, right? These Buddhists are so just downers. Talk about suffering all the time. But there's a good reason why Buddhists talk about suffering, and that's the same reason that if you go to if you go to your doctor, and you have kind of like this. The doctor sees maybe 10 patients an hour. Four to six patients an hour, and they have they have only a certain amount of time with you, and you have something that ails you. And you show up at the doctor's office, and the doctor says to you, "Oh, it's nice to see you. Have you been following the 49ers? And oh, you don't care so much about football. Wasn't it great that the Giants won the World Series? And where were you on vacation last summer? And how about over Christmas? And then they start telling you about their vacation." And so you begin looking at your watch, and you realize that that you have 10 minutes. And what you want the doctor to do is to ask you what ails you. You want to be able to address the issue so you can get over the issue, do something with the issue. So the Buddha, in starting with suffering, was kind of like a doctor. It's often talked to, referred to as a doctor who wants to get to the issue so there can be a cure. So the Four Noble Truths start with suffering. So for those of you who don't know what the Four Noble Truths, I'll tell you what they are first before we go on further. So the first noble truth is suffering. The truth of suffering, the recognition of suffering in our lives. The second noble truth is the truth of the cause or the source of suffering. The source or the cause is said to, suffering arises out of craving, certain kind of clinging, not just desire at all. Some people say source of suffering is desire, but it's very clear the Buddha did not use the word desire. He used a much more powerful word. The word literally means thirst, but I think in English we can say craving. There's a truth of the cessation of suffering. That's the good news. It's possible to bring it to an end. That's the cure. And then there's a way to practice that allows us to bring that suffering to an end. So those are the Four Noble Truths. We'll go into it a little bit more in a minute, a little bit. So here's teachings from the Buddha from the ancient texts. And he was addressing this to his monastic disciples. These are, in our language today, perhaps some of us might say, these are the professionals. And they have dedicated their life to this. And as you probably know, they can recognize that there's some correlation, not a one-to-one correlation, but some correlation to people being dedicated to their religious life professionally as clergy or monastic or something, and to be sometimes a little bit overly zealot about their religion. Like, this is the truth or something. Right? Sometimes. So he's talking to his, religious professionals who have this risk in how they... So he says, monastics, do not engage in disputious talk. Talk about disputes. Saying, you don't understand the teaching. I understand this teaching. You think you understand the teaching? You're practicing wrongly. I'm practicing rightly. What should have been said before, you said afterwards. What you said after, you said before. You're not arguing accurately. I'm consistent. You're inconsistent. What you took so long to think out has been overturned. Your thesis has been refuted. Go off. to rescue your thesis, for you're defeated, or disentangle yourself if you can. So, apparently back in ancient India, there was a huge tradition of debate, and religious debate, and different religious people at the time would go about and debate each other and argue, and so this kind of language kind of reflects this kind of debate about the truth and the Dharma. And why should you avoid speaking this way? Because this kind of talk is not beneficial. It is irrelevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life and does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. So there's arguing about the truth, what is true and not true, arguing what the Dharma is. The Buddha said, and we find a lot of this in Buddhist circles in America. You go from one Buddhist center to another, or one teacher to another, and it's not uncommon to come across, well, you know, you can't believe those people. Over there, they teach this. That's completely wrong. That's not what the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught this. And I'll tell you what the Buddha taught. And I hear so much of this kind of language around. This is still going on. This, in refer to Buddha, in Buddhism, this is the Dharma, this is not the Dharma. I have the Dharma. Those people don't have the Dharma. So the Buddha, in this passage, said that kind of talk is irrelevant for the purpose of becoming free. Because for one reason, you're stuck in views. There's another passage somewhere, the Buddha, someone comes to argue with the Buddha, clearly wants to debate with him in the kind of the old way they're debating. And he said, what are your teachings? And the Buddha says, what do you teach? And the Buddha says, I teach that which, when taught, gives no one any basis to quarrel with me. So that's interesting. That's what he did. Apparently that didn't please the man. So what is it? What can you teach that gives no basis for quarreling, to add to the quarrels? And how do you teach the Dharma if you're not going to be saying, what the truth is? And it's kind of touching, You have to realize that, as I said, started the talk off, that people come to religion, to Buddhism, because they're suffering, they're challenged in their lives. They would like to somehow align themselves or be connected to what seems true. They want to find a way of living that's aligned with the truth, connected to the truth, and have the reassurance that somehow they have a true life, a life that has meaning and purpose. And sometimes people, with the suffering they have, or the sacrifice they make to join a group or a tradition or something, it's kind of human nature to want to feel secure and feel like you're doing something worthwhile and you're right. Mm-hmm. And so it's very natural almost then to kind of say, to hold on to and cling to my way or our way or this way is the truth, and then to fend off the others or to criticize the others. And oftentimes, criticizing other people's teachings in Dharma is a way of bolstering oneself and one's own teaching, reassuring oneself, yes, we're okay, we're safe. We got the truth here. But is that really, that whole movement of holding on to views, to teachings, to ideas, to the Dharma, holding on to what the Buddha taught as an opinion, it does not lead to freedom. It does not lead to peace. So that's basically what the Buddha is saying here. And it's kind of a little bit of a paradox, of course, that here I am reading this and then trying to tell you what the Buddha said. I apologize. And so the Buddha then went on and he says, when you talk, so he's talking, remember, to religious professionals, when you talk, you should talk about this is suffering. You should talk about this is the origin of suffering. You should talk about this as the cessation of suffering. You should talk about this as the way leading to the cessation of suffering. For what reason? Because this talk is beneficial, relevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life, and leads to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, and to nibbana. So, as an alternative to championing certain religious views and ideas, he's offering what in other vocabulary could be called the Four Noble Truths. But here there's a distinction which I think is significant, maybe it's very subtle, and that is he doesn't here call them the Four Noble Truths. And because the danger is when you call it the Four Noble Truths, you're talking about a teaching, which is kind of what I'm doing today, right? The teaching. And you don't want to get caught up in teachings. What he says here, he says something very immediate. He says, this is suffering. And this word, this, so he's pointing to something, it is to point to something particular, not to point to something abstract. So, occasionally in popular America, the first noble truth of the Buddha is referred to erroneously as life is suffering. That's a generalization, an abstraction that just drives some people crazy or depresses them. Because if life is suffering, what hope is there? But the Buddha never said life is suffering. But here, he's being very particular. This is suffering. So it's to learn to identify the particular place of suffering when it exists and to recognize this as suffering, not to generalize about life as a whole. So if you are suffering, if there's grief, despair, anger, the whole slew of fear, a whole bunch of things that can be called suffering, the heart is contracted. If the mind is broken and brittle, then you recognize this particular thing. And this pointing to the particular, to what's actually happening, is the hallmark of Buddhist practice. And people who practice Buddhism by focusing, looking at the teachings or the practice in the abstract, never really get very far. So there has to be a willingness to put aside the abstract teachings that are there, abstract ideas of reality, and be able to connect to the particular details of what's happening here and now. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important in Buddhism for us to practice mindfulness, because mindfulness is a practice that helps to put us in the present moment, which is the only place where we can be particular and see the details of what's happening actually right now. In addition, what we're trying to see right now, the particular, is not only this suffering, but this origin of suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the source or the cause of suffering. And this is the good news. In the ancient time, in the Buddha's time, people were debating about what the nature of suffering was. And they had all kinds of ideas. And one idea was that suffering was just set in motion at the beginning of time, a kind of predetermined view, and there's nothing you can do about it. Things, the dice, or not dice, but the ball had to just keep rolling until momentum rolled out. And there's nothing you could, if you suffered, you just, that's just the way the universe was built, and you just had to kind of go along with it until, whatever is going to happen next. Or the idea that suffering actually was completely in the responsibility of the gods, and if you worship the gods and gave them lots of sacrifices, the gods might grace you with good luck and you would maybe have fortune and things would be better. Some people in the time of the Buddha argued that suffering has no cause whatsoever. It's just causeless, it's just there. Not predetermined, it's just there. Nothing you can do can make any difference. So that was kind of depressing. But in that environment, what the Buddha was saying, which is not so foreign to how many of us think, is that suffering has a reason. There's a cause, there's a source, certain activity of the mind. That suffering, that when human beings experience suffering, Suffering itself is an activity of the mind that arises out of another activity of the mind. So if I look at this nice gentleman here, sitting in front of me, and I say that, you know, men with blue shirts, you know, I'm sorry, but not quite up to what standard should be. So that's unfortunate that I would say that. I apologize. But he might now just be filled with despair. He doesn't come here very often. And, he, it's a long time since I've talked to him, and the first thing I say is something about his shirt, and he respects me as a teacher or something, so this is really crushes him. So that's his suffering. But if you look very carefully at the sequence of what rose to that, was that before the activity of being totally crushed by my statement, was that he was carrying around with him a certain activity, could have, I'm not saying you were, but could have, of feeling like he needed to be someone who, you know, is an upright citizen in our society and be seen a certain way by all these good people. And so he has a certain conceit, and here comes the teacher and says something about, you know, that challenges his image in this group of people. And so the cause of his suffering is not my statement about his shirt. The cause that Buddhism points to is the prior activity of him having a self-image that he was attached to that was threatened. Does that make sense? And you'll forgive me? Otherwise, I'll suffer. And so this is suffering, and then this is the source of suffering, and we want to see the source in the activities of our own mind, what we do, because then we can do something about it. If he had seen the source of his suffering in Mike's silly statement, which is reasonable enough, I mean, I'm conditioned, that said something inappropriate, and and he could have gotten angry with me, and whatever, something could have, more interesting could have happened. Him being upset with me is reasonable enough, but that doesn't help him. he could say something angry and storm out of here, but his suffering isn't because of what I said; it's what he did with what I said. So if what a person wants to do is take responsibility for their suffering, wants to address their suffering and how it can actually be dealt with personally, we have to be in the present moment enough to see where the cause is, where the source is in ourselves. This is not to dismiss the importance of taking care of problems in our world around us, by any means. In fact, to actualize, understand the practice of Buddhism hopefully empowers you to step into the world and take care of things in a much more proper way. And in fact, I know this young man here, and I know that if I said something to him like that he didn't feel good about, that was off, like, he would come up and talk to me afterwards and tell me. He's not going to walk away. That's right, I would think. Wouldn't you, Terry? Yes. I think so. There's a place for that, for dealing with the challenges around us. But Buddhist practice is this is suffering, to identify it, and this is the source. This is and then this is the cessation of it. So the source is said to be in the clinging, or the grasping. A certain kind of activity of obsession or holding on in the mind, contracting the mind around ideas, feelings, sensations, whatever. It's not easy to see this. I mean, sometimes it's very easy to see because it's so obvious what we're doing. The example I like to give, I hope it works as a simple as being in a hurry driving someplace, being impatient to get someplace, and the light turns red in front of you. And you feel all hot and impatient and tense, but you can't blame the red light. If you think about it, the only person who's holding, is causing you to be tense is yourself. And so you can look at the impatience, and you see this impatience is the source of my tension. And so I think I need to kind of take a deep breath and let go of this. That's, you know, so that might be relatively easy driving your car, but there's much, much more deep patterns in the mind and the heart, that some of them get solidified quite early in life around who we are and attitudes about how we see the world around us and ourselves, and that are not so easy to see. And that's why we have the practice of concentration. And concentration practice is a practice of stilling the mind, dropping the mind into deeper and deeper, more subtle areas of the mind, so we can see the subtlety of how the mind works in a way that's often not accessible in ordinary street consciousness we have. And driving the car, you might be able to see something, but... So this is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of it, and this is the way. There's other ways of saying this, and the way I'd like to offer tonight is this is ease, or this is peace, and this is how you lose the peace. This is how you lose the ease, and this is how you can regain the ease. And this is the way to regain the ease. Because there comes a point, a tipping point, I'll say it in two different ways. Some people come to this practice because of their suffering. Some people come to it and they're focusing on suffering and wanting to deal with it. Some people come to the practice because they have a clear intuition or sense of a possibility of peace and ease. They might be suffering, but their sights are set more on the ease and peace that's possible than the suffering that they're experiencing. They're trying to deal with the suffering, but they have more sense of ease. Other people, for whatever, maybe have done this practice for a while, or through some other way, have had a taste of a deep ease, deep peace, which is so meaningful that it becomes a primary guide for their life, a reference point for their lives. That the possibility of having this peace, the knowledge that, yes, I can have it, becomes something that not to be attached to and strive after in a clinging way, but rather something to incline and move towards. This is more important. This peace that I've experienced is more important than worrying about getting someplace on time in my car. Why would I sacrifice this profound sense of inner wealth, you know, over this issue of getting late someplace? You know, I try not to be late, but do I have to give up this wonderful feeling? Do we have to, you know, or do I have to give it up for being upset by someone talks to me about what the kind of clothes I wear? For what do you sacrifice your ease? What is it willing to give up your sense of peace for? And I think it's something that very few people ask themselves. There's often a kind of addiction or a very strong gravitational pull that people have into their suffering, into their, or even more so, into their craving, into what they cling. And they get pulled into clinging and craving and desire, and it takes a long time to realize that they've made a mess of things, that things are not going along as well as they wish. But to ask the question, is it worth clinging? Is it worth getting angry? Is it worth getting caught up in this? And is it worth giving up a sense of ease and peace? I think it's a very interesting question to... As people do Buddhist practice, they get a clearer and clearer sense of ease, of peace, of well-being, and becomes a stronger and stronger reference point. It's kind of the analogy that's given is that of a white piece of cloth. When it's totally stained and dirty, one more spot makes no difference. But if the white cloth has been completely clean and it's completely white and new-looking again, then one spot makes a big difference. So if we're completely caught up in our lives and spinning and racing and anxious and upset and everything's kind of swirling around it all at once, you know, one more thing to cling to doesn't really matter much. You hardly notice. But as a sense of ease and well-being and calm becomes stronger, a sense of happiness becomes stronger, then we notice earlier and quicker that movement of contracting, of clinging, resisting, closing down, as being something that doesn't feel so good. Why would you? It isn't like you have to be a good Buddhist and not cling. That's not any good. But rather, you feel and sense for yourself that it's something you directly know. You sense it. It's like, what you know. If you're walking down on a beautiful, soft sand beach, which feels really good for your feet to go on, and then you see up ahead that there are all these broken pieces of driftwood with nails sticking up, you know, why would you put your foot on the driftwood? Why would you stand on it? You know, you would keep your feet off because you know that it's going to hurt. You don't have to, it's not like an abstract philosophy that, oh, I shouldn't step on the driftwood with the nails. So as the mind cultivates, as the heart and mind has more ease and peace, it kind of becomes like that. It becomes, why would I do this? Why? So early in practice, in classical Buddhist practice, the Four Noble Truths is used as a practice to encourage us to look more carefully at our suffering and the cause of our suffering. And so Buddhist practice, in a kind of way, involves a willingness, an inspired willingness, to stop and look at suffering, which is counterintuitive for many people how they live, where they want to get away from it and fix it and destroy it. But rather to stop and very calmly, very relaxedly, be willing to hang out and get to know, what is this? What is this? Remember the word this. What is this? What is this? What is this? Don't be in a hurry with your suffering. It's a very mature thing to stop and get to know it and hang out with it. It's a very wonderful thing to learn the art, the skill of being with your suffering and not reacting further. Not judging yourself because of it, not being upset with yourself or angry with yourself, not using that as one more piece of evidence that you're lousy. Or you fill in the blank, you know, that just, you know, you're somehow something like lousy. It's a great piece of practice to turn towards suffering, be with your suffering, and not add any more problems on top of it. Just suffer. It's a lot better to just suffer than it's to suffer because you're suffering. So, you know, if you're going to suffer, just suffer. When suffering, just suffer. It's a lot easier that way. And then, as we get to know and hang out and learn not to react to suffering, not to run away from it or attack it or, you know, just be very, very simple with it, then we start having a chance of seeing what is the mental activities, what's going on inside of us that's giving birth to that, that's the source of it, that's the condition for it, for it to be there. And then, as we continue this process, we might slowly learn how to relax that extra activity, let go of the ways in which we cling, we contract, we obsess, we get addicted to what's going on. As I said, sometimes it's easy because it's very clear, and sometimes it's a long path to understand some of the places where we're holding on. But as this practice works and we get to the truth of the cessation, which is the peace at the other side of the clinging, as that becomes stronger and stronger, more palpable and clear, there comes a tipping point in a practitioner's life where the practice is not so much about trying to deal with the suffering, but rather it becomes more about how to stay in touch with or live from the freedom, to live from the peace. Suffering still happens, clinging still might happen, but the reference point is that nearby, close by, there's a lot of peace, there's a lot of ease. And that ease becomes the guide. And then with a lot of ease, then the Four Noble Truths are, this is ease, and this is how I'm losing the ease. Look, there it is. And I've been in situations where I felt some ease, and I've seen my mind go into some pattern, some desire, some wanting, some impulse. And it's kind of like a rubber band. It's like, I see going in a direction is not good. And why would I go there? I just let go, or just like the rubber band just comes back to peace. Just like, you know, why would I go there? Why it's not interesting anymore. There's a great expression the Buddha gave, which is probably a pretty challenging idea. Because he said, at some point, people get disenchanted with suffering. Do you realize you're enchanted by it? There's some kind of addiction or enchantment or under the spell of suffering or under the spell of craving. When we experience peace and ease, then it helps us to break that spell, to break that caught-upness, and that we invest so much value and purpose in clinging, like it's going to help us and save us. To divest ourselves of our clinging, and then to invest ourselves in peace. So the alternative way of formulating the Four Noble Truths, this is ease, this is how ease is lost, this is how ease is regained, and this is the conditions or the practices that lead to regaining. So the practices, the fourth noble truth, is called the Eightfold Path. And this is, I think, a recognition that we want to have an integrated, holistic approach to living our life if what you want to do is to resolve some of the deepest suffering you have in your life. If it's just a matter of how you drive your car and what happens at the red light, maybe then just stress reduction is good, which is a great thing. I'm not going to not, I mean, it's wonderful that's happening in our society. But if what you want is to deal with some of the deepest existential issues of our lives, some of the deepest emotional and psychological challenges that people have, you know, it's not an easy thing. And you want to bring all of yourself into that task. It needs to be integrated with your mind, your heart, your body, with your behavior, with your social life around you. There's no simple key. All of you has to participate in this process. And so the Eightfold Path is a way of bringing all of you involved into the practice. So how you behave, how you speak, how you relate to yourself, what your intentions are, all kind of are important elements. But not as abstract teachings, not as becoming a good Buddhist who has the right and the true Dharma, the true teachings, but rather as a pragmatic and useful and practical approach to deal with the particulars and details of our suffering and our ease and our freedom. There's no need for Buddhists to be religious. And so you don't need to be in disputes about what the Dharma is. If you are disputing with your neighbor about the true religion, then what you want to do is notice this suffering you're having around this dispute. Look at the cause, the source in you of why you're so arguing with your neighbor, and then let go of it. Make sense? So I apologize. I wanted to do a discussion. And I've noticed that the longer Buddhist teachers are a teacher, the more they talk. Occupational hazard. We do have a couple of minutes. It would be nice to hear maybe one comment or question if anyone wants to say anything on this. If I need to make something clear or apologize to someone.
So I'll try to be brief about this because I kind of went through something about being in the suffering mode, something I couldn't really do much about, but I made a choice that led me there. The day was December 14th, and it was actually the day of the Newtown killings. And late in the day, there was an IMC book group here, and I had promoted this book, Michaela Catherine's book, and I was planning, I was definitely going to come here, nothing was going to stop me, et cetera, et cetera. Well, it ended up, I stopped at a store, gave myself plenty of time. I didn't have to do it, but I did it. And it was in near, right in Menlo Park. And I couldn't even get on El Camino Real. It was so crowded. So I figured, oh, I'll go up to Stanford University. I'll go up to 280, and I'll get here. And I still have a reasonable amount of time. Well, there was a multiple fatality on Edgewood Road, this thing that happened the same day, and it took me an hour and a half to get 2 miles. So I totally had to let go of this coming here. And I planned months, you know. And by the way, Shiloh Catherine's a, she teaches in South Mountain View, and she was going to be here that day and answer questions. And I, man, I'm definitely going to come here. So I'm sitting in my car, not knowing what's happening, thinking there was construction, whatever. And I'm sitting there and saying, I didn't have to stop at that place. And it was like there was nothing I could do about it. So I said, okay, I can just be with the suffering, but I'm maybe a little driven at times. I said, can I make something out of this that's maybe better than that? I'll acknowledge the suffering. But I said, you know, there's an affirmation, a kind of a mindfulness affirmation I've been planning on integrating into my life more. Why don't I do it here? And it was something from Thich Nhat Hanh. So I said, you know, I'm gonna probably need to say it a few times to kind of get in the mode. Yes, I know I'm suffering. Yes, I'm beating myself up a little bit. And I'm helpless here. I can't do anything about this. We're going a half a mile an hour. And there's thousands of cars stranded. And I actually did something about it. And it's now part of my life. And I don't know, good or bad, but it's actually a pretty good practice.
It's a great thing to do. Anything that helps you deal with the clinging and let go. And, you know, for those of you who come to a place like IMC, you know, it's come here as a place to help you not suffer. Don't suffer about how you get here. So if you're running late... If you're running late to get here, you know, you can start your IMC practice while you're being late by not suffering about it. But if you really suffer about being late, and it's really burdened by that, come here all stressed, late, then you really need to be here. Welcome. Okay, so great. So thank you. And I hope that this practice of looking at suffering and the cause and looking at ease and peace and what supports it and how you lose it helps you to have a peaceful and meaningful year. Thank you.